Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. In 1992, a team of scientists found the remains of a previously unknown animal with two long, curved, pointed horns, which from the side appeared to merge into one. It was dubbed the Asian unicorn. The animal turned out to be more than a new species. It was a new genus, and the first large mammal discovered in the last 50 years. The Last Unicorn is a story by Dr. William DeBuys of his search to find and understand this very rare animal in the remote reaches of Laos. And we are very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Welcome and congratulations on the reviews you've been getting.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you, Steve.
Laos is a long way from your home and previous work in New Mexico. And maybe we should start with you telling us how that came about and a little more about your book.
Well, the story about how the journey came about sounds a little bit like mustache twirling. I literally had done a project, a bit of reporting in central Borneo concerning conservation efforts to protect a forest where formerly captive orangutans were reintroduced to the wild. And I came back to the States and reported on this project at a meeting of people in Washington, D.C., and a week later I get a call from somebody who had been at that meeting, and he asked me, how would you like to write about Saula? And I said, what? And he explained that Saula are the newly discovered animal that you just described, that they're beautiful, they're very rare, probably number only between a few dozen to a few hundred left in the world. They're restricted to a very small habitat in the mountains that divide Laos and Vietnam. And they're extraordinarily beautiful. And to many a conservation biologist, like the man I was speaking with, they're very inspiring. So I said, sure, count me in. I'd like to know more. And pretty soon, he had arranged for me to travel to Vientiane, Laos, the capital of the country, to attend a meeting, the first meeting, of the newly formed Saula Working Group, which is a committee of the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And this committee consisted of conservation biologists who were coming together to devise strategies that they hoped would help save the Saula from extinction. And so I sat in on a week-long meeting of the committee, and in the course of it got to know an extraordinary individual, Bill Robichaud, who was coordinating the committee. And one thing led to another, and a year and a half later, Bill Robichaud and I together embarked on an expedition into the Nakai Nam Thun National Protected Area in Laos in search of Saula.
So if you like animals at all, it seemed your description of the Saula immediately draws you in. And one of the really interesting things that you describe is Robichaud, is that how you say it?
Robichaud
spent about 2 weeks with a captured Saula in, I think, 1996.
That's correct.
And you write about that a bit on page 137, and I wondered if you could read that for us.
I'd be delighted to. So where we're picking up the story, Robichaud has been watching this animal for days, and the animal is a female and is referred to as her in the next sentence here. A Buddhist monk from a nearby temple came to see her, and he and Robichaud fell to talking. The monk said local people had a nickname for Saula. It was not a term that Sek or Bru or Hmong would use, but certain Lao speakers in the area called the creature Satsupap, which translates roughly as the polite animal. Saula, according to the monk, moves slowly and quietly through the forest. They are never qui d'eux, which is how you might describe a mischievous child. They even eat politely, cleanly nipping off leaves, the leaves that they select, never tearing the foliage with a yank of the head as other browsing animals do. Various hunters have confirmed this trait. They say, in fact, that where a certain plant that Saula favor is found, with its leaves cleanly and uniformly nipped off, Saula are sure to have been present. The monk said that Hmong villagers had captured two other Saula the previous August or September, and without difficulty had kept them virtually as pets for 2 weeks before undertaking to walk the animals 60 kilometers to Lak Sao. Unfortunately, the Saula died along the way.
Well, thank you for that reading. And, you know, one of the things that comes across is this: the Saula is almost a Zen-like animal. It does harken back kind of to the mythical unicorn of the West.
Indeed it does. The Saula possesses a kind of serenity that is completely unusual among wild animals. Within just a very little time, Robichaud could go into the pen with the wild Saula that he observed for 2 weeks. He could go into the pen, and the animal would not even jerk up its head when he touched her. After a while, he was picking ticks out of her ears. She was tamer, he said, than any farm-raised goat or sheep or cow he'd ever experienced on a Wisconsin farm where he grew up.
So that's amazing, and I guess it's just as amazing that this turned out to be a new genus. And I don't think I remember my high school biology all that well, but that means like it's the only surviving member of a family, and the whole rest of the family's gone. Is that what genus?
Well, basically, it means that the Saula has no close evolutionary relatives. The Saula may even be the sole member of its tribe taxonomically, but the scientific community has not agreed on that question yet. But basically, the nearest relatives Saula have are wild cattle, like bison and buffalo and the ancestors of our own domestic cattle. But those relatives are not at all close. It's as though the Saula is a stub off the evolutionary tree that came very close to the trunk and isn't close to any other stubs off the tree.
So one might wonder, you know, how an animal like this could even survive in the wild. But it's got an incredible defense mechanism, which Robichaud found out about when a dog went by.
Well, that's right.
The pen, right?
The Saula have been restricted to their high, high mountain habitat for a very, very long time. They're an old species, and they seem to have been in the same place for possibly millions and millions of years. And they do have a very interesting reflex. When any member of the dog family, any kind of canid, comes by and they get a whiff of its scent, a Saula will go into an alarm position with its head down, horns pointed forward. If there's water nearby, it will jump into a stream and stand in for it chest-deep water of, you know, a couple of feet deep, with its back hopefully to a boulder or to a cut bank, and there stand to defend itself against any kind of dog. The Saula seems to have evolved in close contact with Dhole, D-H-O-L-E, the Asiatic wild dog, and the Dhole evidently were the principal predators on Saula, and so this reaction is very deeply and instinctively ingrained in the animal.
So the Saula doesn't eat grass, right? It only eats the certain kinds of rare plants in this very tiny area in Laos, whereas most bovids, I guess, evolved to eat grass as grass became more prevalent.
That's exactly right. In the Miocene, many of the forests of the world began to shift to savannas and grasslands. And the Saula's distant cousins, other wild cattle, began to move out into those environments and specialize in eating grass. The Saula didn't do that. The Saula stayed in its forest environment and only browsed.
Now, you say forest, but I'm
woody
sorry.
Trees.
Yeah, you say forest, and to me, I guess I would describe it as a jungle because it likes this hot, wet, tropical area. That's where it wants to live, right?
That's right. But then again, one man's forest is another man's jungle. It depends how at home you are in the environment.
Well,
your degree of familiarity might color whether you call a place a jungle or a forest.
Yeah, and you don't use the word jungle in your book. You use the word forest.
Well, I try to use the word forest, but I'm afraid my own experience there, I felt pretty out of place myself. And the more I felt out of place, the more I began to view my environment there as a jungle and not a forest.
Well, let me mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the phone from the University of Montana, where he is a writer-in-residence, New Mexico author William DeBees, and we're talking about his most recent book, The Last Unicorn. And one question that one has, and you write about this too, is why this trip? And why preservationists do what they do. You know, at first I thought maybe Robichaux and this whole trip was kind of unnecessary. You know, why not just hire locals to put up camera traps and look for the Sala? But, you know, it turns out that Robichaux is perhaps the preeminent expert on the Sala. There's no better person to look for its habitat than him. And he also knew how to put up the camera traps. So there's a lot of reason for that. But, well, why don't you react to that first before I go on with that question?
Well, indeed, the book is the story of an expedition looking for Sala habitat and also trying to evaluate poaching pressure, the general pressure on wildlife in these very, very wild forests. But as an expedition, you can think of it as a kind of quest. We were going out looking for one thing. And in a way, what we found was something else. And what we found was the motivation to keep on working back in these lands, these forests, where, according to Robichaux, some of the areas where we were, no blue eyes, except for his and mine, had ever gazed upon these lands. We were really in the back of beyond.
Yeah, and I think, it seems like, one of the motivations for Robichaux is surely that he would love to have been the first Westerner to see the Sala in the wild and maybe have a integral part in trying to save it. But on page 245, you explain that there's just a lot more than that involved, and it really relates to your last answer. And I wonder if you could read that passage for us on page 245.
Sure. Here we go. If you probe deep enough among the people who labor in the vineyard of species protection, you find another answer, another motivation. It goes by many names, and it often goes unmentioned, ceding primacy in formal publications to the usual quasi-economic analyses of costs and benefits, or to the unprovable umbrella argument that small tears in the fabric of life will lead to big rents that endanger humankind. Robichaux, like many others, says that what gets him out of his sleeping bag in the morning is something different and simpler. It's beauty. No matter how it's parsed or how much it resides in the eye of the beholder, no matter how its elements might be divided among delight, awe, surprise, or inspiration, beauty moves the heart as reason moves the mind. Imagine a world deprived of the tanager's colors, of the hummingbird's whir, of the mad shrieks of a rookery of seabirds. Imagine the Arctic without its fearsome white bear, Bengal without its tiger, the Serengeti without its prides of lions, pride being an ancient and meaningful term. We are entranced by beautiful creatures not just because they give pleasure and inspire awe, but because they carry a charge like an ionized particle. Beauty excites and glows. Put a horse in an empty meadow and the meadow becomes animate. Put a Sala, even a sowla you cannot see in a forest, and the forest, as though it held a unicorn, acquires an energy that cannot be named. It becomes numinous. It gains the pull of gravity, the weight of water, the float of a feather.
You know, that's a beautiful reading, Bill, and I really appreciate it. And actually calls to my mind a question, which is, you know, you're a writer in residence in the environmental department, I think, at the University of Montana. You were able to take this adventure and turn it into this nonfiction story. And I'm wondering, you know, are there lessons? Are there takeaways? Are there things that you would say that, you know, how did you do this? How did you go about it? Is there some way to describe it in a sort of simple way for people like me who don't write this way, who've never written this way?
Well, for me, as a writer, I think one of the reasons I am a writer is because it's through writing that I really process experience. It's through writing that I understand my life to the extent I manage to understand it. And so going on this expedition with Robichaud, one of the great adventures of my life, I must say, what I did was simply to take notes on everything all the time. And when I got back to the States and could get those notes transcribed, then the shape of our expedition, which was a journey, you know, it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. That shape of the journey provided the structure for the narrative of the book, and I knew that I would be able to digress at important places in the narrative to be able to provide background on the discovery of sowla or some of the issues of the wildlife trade or to rhapsodize a little bit about beauty. And the structure was a natural one, and writing the book, it was a lot of work, of course, but it was really a joy to explore that experience a second time through this literary effort.
If you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the phone from the University of Montana a writer in residence there, Dr. William DeBuys. We're talking about his latest book, The Last Unicorn. It's a story of his journey to Laos to learn more about the first large mammal discovered in the last 50 years. The name of the mammal, the sowla. And I want to talk to you now or turn to you now, turn to the question of preserving the sowla. And one of the, I don't want to spoil anything about the book, like whether you or anyone else on this expedition see one, whether the camera traps you set up, one of the things you were doing was setting up all these camera traps. In other words, traps that would somehow trigger the camera to go off to see if you could capture a sowla. I don't want to talk about that, but I think we can mention that a sowla, a camera trap did capture a sowla in 2013, about a year and a half ago, which means they are still around. They still exist, or at least they existed a year and a half ago. And I guess there's so much to ask about the preservation of them. And one of the things that's so odd about this is the sowla is being trapped not because it's such a unique, wonderful animal, but because there's all these efforts to trap other animals, and the sowla's just caught in the traps.
Well, that's right. The biggest threat to the continued existence of sowla is the poaching that takes place all over its habitat, and that involves professional gangs, professional hunters going into the habitat and building snare lines, by which I mean hedges of brush. They chop brush and throw the chopped brush into a kind of fence, and every 3 meters or so, there's a gap in this hedge of brush, and in each gap, they put a snare, a loop of bicycle brake cable tied to a spring pole. And if the animal steps in the gap and triggers the snare, then that loop closes around its foot, and the animal is flipped into the air and then dies hanging there, a very long, slow, cruel death. And the biggest danger to Sala is to be taken in these snares inadvertently. Sala aren't the target animal, but in a sense, every animal is targeted. Every animal in the forest is vulnerable to these things. And these snares, the same snare that can trap a deer, will have a trigger sensitive enough that the footfall of only a pheasant will set it off. So these traps take all the animals that walk, all kinds of birds that move around on the ground, and these forests are being deprived, they're being shorn of their wildlife at a terrific rate in order to feed the market for animal-based medicinal cures in traditional Chinese medicine, and also to feed status bushmeat restaurants, principally in China, but also in Vietnam. And as the economies of those countries expand, there are more millionaires every year who can afford the very expensive cures that require python fat or monkey hands or turtle blood or deer bone or whatever. It's not just rhinoceroses and tigers that are falling prey to this ravenous appetite for wildlife products, but it's many, many scores of other species of animals. And the Sala may be swept up in this and taken away from us before the world really knows very much about it.
So how long was your journey end-to-end, just the walking part of it?
We were three weeks in the bush looking for Sala and sign of Sala.
And you found and took down about 1,000 snares, right?
Yeah, we collected about 1,000 snares really in just 4 days. It was remarkable.
In 4 days?
The density of snares that we encountered. And the Sala working group operating in, I think, five different protected areas in Laos, Vietnam, its efforts have led to the collection of 90,000 snares in those five areas in just a couple of years.
So what's really astounding is this is in a so-called protected area.
That's right.
It's obviously not very protected.
That's right. So often in that part of the world, protection exists only on paper and not in fact. And the crying need where we were and in many, many areas, other areas of Southeast Asia, is for aggressive patrol and law enforcement to take place in the protected areas so that they really are protected. People like Robichaud are working constantly to raise funds for Sala conservation. And they're having pretty good success, but they need to have a lot more success so we can forward the cause a lot faster.
Well, my sense from the book is the protected area still isn't very protected.
That's true. And we need to bring to bear even more resources and even more sort of moral and political encouragement for the government of Laos.
And meanwhile, I mean, you describe some of the villagers and their circumstances. I mean, they're living in they're subsistence farmers that literally aren't getting enough to eat. I mean, to the extent they trap animals, it's because they're hungry. Go ahead.
A lot of the villagers will snare animals around their swiddens, which is to say the patches of forest that they have cleared for growing rice. But the real damage being done is by professional poachers who come across the mountains from Vietnam. We're not too worried about the low level of snaring and hunting that goes on near the villages. It's the professional gangs coming across the mountains that are the real threat to Sala and to the rest of the wildlife of that biome.
So the professional trade in animals, in poaching animals, that's the
commercial market trade.
The commercial market trade.
Yeah.
So that sort of brings us, we're nearing the end of the show, and that kind of brings us to sort of the bottom line question, which is, if you can look forward, next generation, say 25 years, what do you think the chances are that there'll be wild salad? What do you think the chances are that maybe some could be captured, you know, bred and returned to the wild? I mean, what are the chances of actually being able to have these wonderful animals, you know, residing in their native habitat for the next generation?
Well, I think the chances are still pretty good. And even if we lose the sala, even if the sala does go extinct, there are other animals in that same area, in that same biome, that merit our admiration and fascination and our efforts for protection. The trick in all this is probably to try to protect key habitats, like the place where we went, like Nakai Nam Tun, to protect those places and really patrol them and enforce the law aggressively for the next generation or so, while cultural values in China and in other places in Asia gradually change and result in diminishing the appetite for wild animal products. Right now, we're already seeing that in the shark fin trade for shark fin soup. I'm sure you and your listeners have heard of shark fin soup. Well, in Guangzhou, China, the hub of trade in shark fins, the demand for shark fins has been reduced by 82% in just the last couple of years. And fully two-thirds of Chinese consumers who responded to a poll on this subject said that they had given up eating and serving shark fin soup because of public awareness campaigns. So the possibility for changing those cultural values, for moving to a sort of mode of being that is kinder to wildlife in that part of the world, that possibility exists. It's just going to take time to realize it.
Well, Bill, if listeners were so moved, what would you suggest they do to try to help with this issue?
Well, first they could check out the website of the SALA Working Group, which is savethesala.org, I think it is. Save the SALA, and SALA is SAOLA. And right there they can find out about all kinds of things that are being done to help SALA, and they can also see ways that they can join in helping to conserve SALA.
I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I would like to thank William DeBuise. He is the author of The Last Unicorn. Thanks also to my producer, Jefferson White. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are searchable at iTunes under Stephen Spitz. Archives of my past shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.